Hello, everyone, and welcome to this special edition of Control Amplified. I'm Len Vermillion, editor-in-chief of Control Global, which you know includes Control Magazine. And this month, we're talking to the newest class of the Process Automation Hall of Fame. Now in its 26th year, the Hall of Fame features some of the most notable practitioners and educators of process control. And now there are a few new members. Today, we're going to talk with one of those new members, Manfred Morari, who is Professor of Electrical and Systems Engineering at the University of Pennsylvania. And as some of you probably know, he's done some really interesting research and work in model predictive control, which we're going to talk about in just a bit. But first, Manfred, let me congratulate you on being voted into the Hall of Fame, which of course is nominated and selected by the existing members. So how does it feel to receive this honor?
Len, when I got your email, I was surprised. And when I looked through the list of past awardees, I was humbled because about 30 of them I know very well. And over the years, I've valued their technical contribution and their professional advice.
Wonderful. Great. So I'm sure they want to hear about you. We all want to hear about you and we'll hear your story. So why don't we go all the way back and start at the beginning, so to speak? So you grew up in Graz, Austria. I hope I pronounced that correctly. So what made you interested in engineering in general and led you to start studying it?
Then the answer is pretty simple. I was inspired by my high school chemistry teacher. And he also taught me physics and mathematics. And so he had a big impact on my thinking and my taste.
Okay. Yeah, that's wonderful. I know teachers definitely inspire people. And so you ended up studying chemical engineering at ETH in Switzerland, and then you came to the States for graduate studies later. So why don't we talk a little bit about, you know, your time in ETH and how did you choose the University of Minnesota for your grad work?
Yes, actually, from today's perspective, it probably sounds complicated. And at that time, it was complicated because when I was about to make my choice about graduate school, that was 1974, the means of communication between Europe, Switzerland, and the U.S. were very limited. A phone call was expensive. Obviously, anything video was totally out of question. So everything was by mail. And so I had very little information to go on choosing a department for graduate school. And the only facts then that I knew about Minnesota was what people on the street are talking about, namely that Minnesota is very cold. And the other thing is that was in some Time magazine article of that time that the state bird in Minnesota was the mosquito. So this was not enough to decide on graduate school, but I was very lucky that at ETH, one of the senior researchers whom I met in one of the exercise sessions. One of those researchers, his name was Rex Reed. He had received his PhD in chemical engineering from the University of Minnesota. And he somehow made it his mission to convince me to go to Minnesota for graduate school. And I would say, fortunately, he succeeded. And I was forever grateful to him for pointing me in this direction, obviously giving me letters of recommendations and so on.
Wonderful. So I know after Minnesota, I believe you started teaching at Wisconsin and then actually at Caltech. Quick aside, I'd say between Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Caltech, you fell right into the home of the Hall of, you'll feel right at home with the Hall of Famers that we have here because there's several members. with connections to those three universities. Not surprising, given their reputations in the industry. But I'm digressing. So why don't you tell me about your time at those other two schools that are teaching, and at Caltech, where I believe you co-founded the Interdisciplinary Department of Control and Dynamical Systems. Is that how you say it?
That's correct, Len.
Okay.
When I was about to choose my faculty position or the schools that I would interview, that was in the late 1970s. At that time, there was some official ranking of the different departments that was kind of published every 2 years, and there was a serious effort that went into this ranking. And at that time, so in 77, Minnesota was ranked, chemical engineering at Minnesota, I should say, was ranked number one. Wisconsin was ranked number two. And Caltech, I don't remember exactly, but certainly in the top 10, maybe even top five. So I chose Minnesota, as I said, for graduate school, and I loved the program at Minnesota because it was very theory oriented. And the graduate students were excellent. It was very tough to compete. And I always say that this first quarter at Minnesota was the toughest, and I had never worked harder in my life than this time at Minnesota. And as a PhD advisor, I chose an at that time really unknown assistant professor by the name of George Stephanopoulos. He was just a few years older than I. And so we, it was, I would say for me, it was kind of a risky choice. You know, you come as a new graduate student and you pick as an advisor somebody who has no reputation. Okay. But I was lucky. And so we worked together because of this small age difference, or just a few years. We worked together like colleagues and became friends. And so from George, I learned how to formulate research problems. Okay, we also learned how to solve problems, but even more important was his approach to formulating research problems. And so that was Minnesota. And then at Wisconsin, I interviewed the number of schools when I was about to finish my PhD in Minnesota. And I received a number of offers. And the one I accepted was Wisconsin, which, as you recall, as I just said before, was number two in chemical engineering. And Wisconsin was, for me, again in retrospect, clearly the perfect place because they practiced mentorship, mentorship for the young faculty, and I benefited from that. And in particular, I have to mention the frank advice which I received from my colleague Harmon Ray was invaluable. And by the way, he's another one of the people I
I
met during
remember
my
it.
career who was inducted to the Hall of Fame just
I
a few
think it
years
was just 2 years ago, actually.
ago. I don't recall exactly, but it was quite recent, yes. And I was very happy at Wisconsin those 6 years, and I learned enormously much due to those personal interactions. But then I left Madison, and why did I leave Madison? It was really totally personal. I was going to get married, and my wife, with a fresh MBA from Northwestern University, could not find suitable employment in Madison. And when I say suitable employment, at that time she was a vegetarian, and the job that was available was Oscar Mayer meatpacking in Madison. Okay.
I see.
So it was not a good match. And
Okay.
so together we moved to California.
Okay. Well, there, that's a better place for a vegetarian, I would think.
And the intellectual atmosphere, I must say, that I encountered there at Caltech was, and I still repeat that, was unparalleled. I managed there after some startup, I managed to attract other researchers in the control and dynamical systems area to Caltech, and in particular a person by the name of John Doyle, not in process control, but otherwise in the control field, a real giant. And together with him and a few other people at Caltech, we formed a new department with the focus of control and dynamical systems. And I would claim that it became one of the world centers in this area.
All right. Well, wonder. Well, that's quite a lot right there. And I believe after that you probably, I think you went back to ETH. Am I right with that? Somewhere after
That's
that, and I know there's another laboratory
correct,
there for you.
Len.
Yeah.
That's correct. And again, why would somebody move from Caltech? Okay, Caltech
Right.
is kind of the climax of the academic world. So again, it was really a personal decision. And a personal decision because, as you mentioned, I am originally from Graz, from Austria, at least from Europe. And I knew at that time at Caltech, and that was 94. I knew that, and I was about 35. I knew that staying in the US at that time in my life would have meant that I will never return to Europe, okay? Because you don't move faculty positions when you're 50 or 60 or so on. And the other point was that for me to go to Europe, it was also clear if I go to Europe, I would want to go to ETH, okay? Because at least at that time, it was so good repute that I would not have gone anywhere else. So those two factors made me to move back to ETH. So what was the experience at ETH? I only had experience as an undergraduate, and you really don't know about the daily research life as an undergraduate. And I found very quickly when I came then as a faculty member that the resources at the ETH were almost unlimited, so personnel and funds, etc. But the quality of the graduate students, at least in that institute, was not comparable to what I was used to at Caltech. So I had to start recruiting, active recruiting of graduate students, and I recruited mostly in Southern and Eastern Europe. There, people were had excellent education and were ready to move because they had little chance to develop their career in their home countries. And I would say at that time I attracted several of the future world leaders in the field to come to ETH and to work with us.
So then I know you were at ATH for a long time at that point, and you actually ended up retiring there, and then you came back to the US to Philadelphia and the University of Pennsylvania. So the question begs, why did you decide to come get back into teaching after retirement for starters and come back to the
Good
US?
question. And one issue about ETH, and it has been somewhat relaxed, has somewhat relaxed now, but at that time it was clear with 65 mandatory retirement. Okay. And at least at 65, I was not ready to retire. And I made this known to people in the US. Obviously, I had many contacts there, and I immediately got several offers to return to the US. And among those, I chose Penn, and I was very happy at Penn then, because the whole talent pool and the interests at Penn at that time, I felt was a perfect environment for me to move into, and also to move the research into a different area, which then became the center or the center of attention of the whole field of control, and that's learning and control. So adaptive control had kind of come and gone, but learning and control was the new direction that people followed. And actually, I was the first plenary speaker in a conference, L4CD, that's Learning for Control and Dynamical Systems, that took place at MIT, and it really started. What we see there started very, what we see now started very much there.
Okay. So education was the main part of your career, but you also held some industry positions as well, particularly, I believe, at Exxon. Can you talk about those experiences?
Absolutely, they were very important for me. And the first summer as an assistant professor at Wisconsin, I was invited by the Exxon recruiter to spend some time at Exxon in New Jersey, which was very valuable. Then ICI, which you may not even know, it's Imperial Chemical Industry. It was at that time the biggest company in the UK. Okay, that has been all been split up. Then Shell, BP, was on the technical advisory board. We actually reported once a year. We reported to the CEO, and United Technologies, which has now become Raytheon and Carrier, and was also split up and changed. And in all those appointments, I feel I brought them my technical or theoretical expertise. And what I got back from the companies, I learned about real problems, okay, which are very difficult to get to as in academia, real problems which were of practical economic interest.
Okay. So at the beginning, I promised we were going to talk about model predictive control. So why don't we do that now? And since some of our listeners and viewers may out there may not be really familiar with it, why don't you try? Can you explain what it is?
Yeah, so you're asking for the 1 minute introduction to
Yeah,
MPC.
it a try.
So I would say there are a few ingredients, and that's how things are usually presented. You start with some mathematical model of the system that you want to control. Okay, that's essential. As you operate the system, you have some target that is specified over some time horizon, and that's where you want the plant to go. And then, as a the next step, you actually do the control computation. Namely, you use this model that I talked about, and you calculate what inputs do you need in the system that then. So that the system follows the prescribed trajectory. That's fine, but because of the disturbances and model error, etc., you implement only the first one of those input moves, and then you shift the horizon and you repeat the calculation. So that's a, it's a, I would say it's a trajectory optimization, and you could see the same thing in economics or at some other discipline. And why were they interested in MPC and didn't follow their more standard technology? The big advantage of MPC is that in this formulation, as I described it, you can easily deal with complications, which are showstoppers for other techniques, like multivariable system, constraints, nonlinearities, they're easily incorporated in MPC while they all require special version when you use other techniques.
Okay. Well, how did you get interested in MPC? And I don't, why don't you tell us that story?
It was a seminar that a couple of people from Shell presented at the University of Wisconsin. And I must say, I thought the seminar was terrible. And I even told you, but somewhere I felt there was some idea, okay? And it was some idea that I hadn't heard about from other people. And so we made it our mission to try to understand what those people at Shell were doing, and that was very, very useful. And I would say that the main person we were inspired by was Charlie Cutler at Shell, and he, much before we were exposed to this, he described the basic idea about MPC in his proposal for his PhD at the University of Houston in 1969. And he actually dropped out for several years out of the PhD program. He worked at Shell, and then he wanted to go back and get his PhD. That was his pride. And so I was actually one of the reviewers of his PhD thesis. So this is almost absurd, but this is how it happened. And so Cutler, by the way, was also inducted to
Yes, he was,
the Hall of Fame.
it's quite a group of people.
I was very impressed, as I said. And what held back the progress that Cutler had conceptually made is that the computers were not powerful enough to do all the computations that Cutler had imagined. The concept was there, but the implementation had to grow, and it obviously it evolved, and now computation doesn't matter how complicated, it's not an issue anymore.
Okay. Well, how long, and I guess it, in what capacity did you work on this kind of research with, MPC and, follow up, I guess, how did it move from ideas to methodology?
I really do not want to take too much credit for us. It was not only us, it was many other groups in academia and industry who worked on different aspects of that concept, the computation, the formulation, the stability proofs, etc. And so there was a continuous, over the years, the decades, there was a continuous interplay of process engineers and control theoreticians.
And obviously it had a an impact on the field. So what kind of applications did it lead to, and how, how's it been applied?
MPC, I would describe it as a enabling technology,
Mm-hmm.
enabling for many problems that go much beyond what we are discussing here, process engineering. So, for example, actually, Carlos Garcia, whom
Yes,
I mentioned
another
before,
one.
he pointed out to me recently a paper that was published in 1964, so even before Cutler, that describes an algorithm and describes it very neatly, mathematically, like MPC. And what they were studying is the control of re-entry of aerospace vehicles. So a totally different application. And so another example for this universal applicability of MPC is robotics. So now if you go to some robotics meeting and you hear about people talking about algorithms for controlling robots, almost certainly you will hear that they have organized themselves around MPC.
Yeah, definitely. Wonderful. So, Manfred, I want to get your thoughts on some of the industry topics that we're talking about a lot these days. And so let's start with, your area, engineering education. What do you really think the differences are with today's, I'll say, students and curriculum versus, what happened in your earlier days of teaching?
I think it has totally changed, and it's about to change further. And though I'm by no means an expert, and my knowledge is very limited about the AI, but it is quite apparent that AI is revolutionizing education. Now, do we understand how we can use the power of AI to education? I don't think so. Okay, we have many people are trying. There's an effort I just read about where they're trying to just collect materials in this direction. But we have to learn a lot to take the to make the best use of it. But I think it will strongly affect our future teaching and practice.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of people trying to figure out the answer to that question in a lot of different
Exactly.
places in the world. So what about when we talk about future workforces and we have a workforce dilemma that the industry faces, and you're on the front lines of educating the next great, control engineers. So why should we be excited about what they'll bring to the field?
And I believe very strongly that what we have to make sure is that the people we attract, and we attract into the universities, they attract in industry, that those are the best. Okay, it's easier said, but I believe very strongly that with the best, things will sort out. Okay. ETH, I was very happy. I mean, I'm now retired officially on those 10 years. At ETH, I would say we have witnessed an explosion of interest from students just growing in the last 10 years, interest in doing research in it and to in the courses that are offered to attend those courses and to graduate with degrees in this area. And so the signs, I think, are good.
Wonderful. Okay, so everything's not about work. So let's find out a little bit about you outside of work. What do you like to do in your spare time? Do you have any hobbies or activities?
And I would say the hobbies, I really don't. I have so many interests, but I wouldn't
Okay.
call them hobbies.
All
In
right.
terms of activities, I very much like mountain biking,
Okay.
and I like also skiing. Skiing is not next door. Mountain biking is right next door, and so Switzerland in general is a great place to
Okay.
for those activities.
I can't imagine anywhere better for either of those.
Exactly.
All right. So before we go, I'm wondering if we can look back on your career and what would you say has made the biggest impact, first on your direction and overall direction the field has taken. So.
I think for me, and we discussed that a bit before, I feel very strongly that the biggest impact has come from the people, and for me, for the people that I was fortunate to work with. And it's not just a statement. I follow those people and I keep in touch with them. And not all of them, but my former students and co-workers, and they're probably about 85 PhD students and maybe 20, 30 postdocs. Many have taken positions of major responsibility in academia or industry. And I'm just going to mention a few. Some of them I mentioned before, but they are kind of exemplary for this group of people. So there's Carlos Garcia. He just retired a couple of years ago. He was one of the pioneers of MPCHL. who was elected to the Hall of Fame. Sigurd Skogestad, I didn't mention yet. He dominated the field with his research and textbook. He was also inducted to the Hall of Fame. But some of the actually a large number of students, former students, I had moved into different areas. And so one for example is probably at the moment the most prominent at least in Switzerland is Pascal Grieder. He was at McKinsey for about 15 years, and then he was heading a mobile phone company for 6 or 7 years, a small one in Switzerland, and now he's CEO of the Swiss post office with about 50,000 employees. I have other people at banks. Some people work on AI in the retail sector. So it's a great group of people, and I'm very happy that with most of them I have very close contact still, even after many years.
So, final question, and I won't ask you to be a prognosticator here, and you've sort of answered these a little bit already, but what do you think the future of the field might look like? Or
Maybe it is my ignorance, but I really think that AI will have an enormous impact that we have not digested, really, the use of AI in the context of control, in particular MPC. But there has been work, and actually with one of my former postdocs, in the other direction. In the other direction, I mean, not AI for control, but actually using the control tools to understand AI and to understand, for example, learning system. That has only started, but from interactions in both of the directions, I expect a major impact.
Wonderful. Well, Manfred, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk to us today, and congratulations again on being named to the Hall of Fame. So.
Thank you very much, Len, and thank you for the induction, and thank you for putting together this interview.
Yeah, no problem. And I want to thank everybody for listening and viewing. So, we will be back with another new Hall of Famer on our next episode. Until then, we'll see you.